tonight on Arena. On TV, Sirens, Little Disasters and Season 2 of Nine Perfect Strangers, and new albums from Sparks, Stereolab and Amble, all of them up for review. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. You can watch us on rte.ie/arena. And we'd start with our TV reviews this evening. Prime Video brings us Season 2 of Nine Perfect Strangers. Nicole Kidman is back as the mysterious Russian guru, Masha Dmytrychenko, who, despite being under investigation for her controversial clinical methods that she was caught for in Season 1, she invites nine new strangers to a wellness retreat, this time in the Austrian Alps, to help them heal and transform their lives. Little Disasters, six-part psychological thriller on Paramount Plus. Series follows Liz, played by Jo Joyner, an A&E doctor who faces an ethical dilemma when her close friend Jess, Diane Kruger, brings in her baby with a suspicious head injury. Duty and loyalty are the two problems that Jo Joyner's character has. Her decision sets off a chain of events that tests both women and indeed their circle of friends. Sirens, then, is a new satirical drama on Netflix. Chaotic Devon, played by Megan Fahey, visits her successful sister Simone, dead of Millie Alcock, at her workplace on a luxurious island estate. But she becomes unsettled at the power that Simone's wealthy boss, Michaela, played by Julianne Moore, has over her. Determined to intervene, Devon gets entangled in a seductive world of privilege and a lot of money. Those are our three series up for discussion. And with me in studio, as usual, Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon. The wellness industry is alive. I can't say and well, can I? But alive and getting better and improving and finding itself. Certainly having a TV moment. We're just finished Season 3 of White Lotus. And now we're back with Season 2 of Nine Perfect Strangers. Nicole Kidman as Masha Dmytrychenko, secretive Russian therapist who certainly has questionable treatment methods. Did I say Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon? I did. Did we need another season of Nine Perfect Strangers?
No, Chris? We didn't. Masha has questionable methods, I should add. She has questionable wigs and a questionable accent as well. Nine Perfect Strangers was originally designed as a miniseries, an adaptation of Liam Moriarty's novel. And there is like another Liam Moriarty novel, which we'll be talking about a little bit later again, Big Little Lies. There was just one self-contained story and that's it. It's supposed to be a one and done deal. But Nine Perfect Strangers broke all kinds of records for Hulu, the streaming service that it aired on in America. So of course a second was ordered. So we're not working with any sort of pre-existing blueprint here. We're not working with any ideas that Moriarty had down.
Was Moriarty involved in this?
I think she retains like an executive producer credit, maybe as a consultant, but this is a whole new story for Masha. So the first time around we saw that Masha, you know, she had all of these, you know, nine very wealthy strangers in Tranquillum House. She was experimenting on them. You know, they were all taking psychotics and they didn't know it. They were all, you know, speaking to dead relatives and they didn't know that they were being experimented on. But that big secret is out now in Season 2, and one of the guests the last time around, Melissa McCarthy's frustrated novelist Frances, she went ahead and wrote a book called Nine Perfect Strangers in this series. So everybody knows that Masha is, you know, has been doing things she shouldn't. She's also the subject of multiple federal investigations, but none of that seems to matter because she has someone in her life who still allows her to do the things that she did in Season 1. So she's in the Bavarian Alps this time. There's nine new strangers. Away we go.
All right, well, before we get into who those nine new people are, let's have a listen to the moment when Masha, the Nicole Kidman character, arrives at the Alpine retreat. Resident scientist Martin, played by Lucas Englander, explains some of his ideas for the trial. I think there might be a little chemistry between the two of them.
Maybe we should also do their blood work again upon their arrival, or at least measure their systolic and diastolic pressures, just to be safe. Masha, I would at least need that data as a baseline.
You make it sound so fun.
I make it sound like a science. That is what it is.
Until it isn't. You seem very tense, Martin. Is there something you want to say to me?
Well, with full respect, you were invited here to Tsablova to bring your art and your passion, both of which are beyond reproach.
And what do you bring?
Discipline.
Very nervous little fellow.
Here we go.
Here we go where?
When you get nervous, you like to deflect, intoxicate with a smile, a smell, or an accent. that you can willingly lose, by the way, I guess, depending on whether Putin offends your consumer base or not.
We have been put in the sandbox to play together, so we can play nice or not.
No improv with the dosage. No dosing without consent. No dosing yourself while charged with supervision. And no locking people up.
Oh. Yes. Yes, sir.
There must be boundaries. I insist on it.
And I must obey.
I will just attend to the...
Of course, attend to all of it.
There you go. That is Lucas Englander as Martin, the scientist who has to tell Masha, the Nicole Kidman character, what she's going to be allowed or not allowed to do. But of course, she's going to break all those rules. He's a new character, and there's his boss and the owner of this retreat, Helena, played by Lena Olin's new character. But I guess the nine perfect strangers, you would think, should be the interest point here. But you could nearly, if you looked up, if you asked ChatGPT for nine perfect strangers, I think you'd probably get these nine people, would you?
This whole show feels like it was dialed in through ChatGPT half the time, because I think we're just at this breaking point, I think, of 1% TV, or the dark side of the 1%. And I think, you know, you can...
1% being the 1% that are of the world that are wealthy than,
exactly.
wealthier than all of the rest of us.
And especially in this current climate, you can understand why writers want to focus on what motivates them and how the intersect into our lives. But I think, I mean, maybe if we start with Succession, like maybe from the brilliance of Succession, it just became a duplication.
Yeah.
And even through Mike White was struggling, I think, this season with The White Lotus to try and get something new out of these horrible characters, to try and get us to care about the rich in that way.
So what you don't need then is a set of archetypes or, you know, cliches.
Which,
what
unfortunately,
do we get?
They are. We have this strange White Lotus crossover where Murray Bartlett, who is the initial White Lotus hotel manager, the ever harried Armand, he's now Brian. He's a former children's TV presenter, and he's dealing with deep anger issues after he was cancelled for an onset outburst. Then you have this depressed piano virtuoso, Tina. She's played by the pop star King Princess, and she's hoping for this relaxing spa vacation.
She's there with her girlfriend.
And her girlfriend has very much different ideas to that. So she doesn't know that this is going to be something run by Masha at all. So that's a surprise for her. And then you have Henry Golden's Peter. He wants to reconnect with his billionaire father, David, who's played by Mark Strong, who also has previous connections with Masha. And then there's this former nun, Agnes, played by Dolly de Leon, and she wants to, you know, probably seek an absolution for something deep and dark in her past.
And there's a mother-daughter in there too.
Yes, with Christine Berinsky, who I think is a great actress, but the problem is she's not doing anything different. She's exactly what you expect a Christine Berinsky character would be at this stage. Like, she's hiding behind these massive sunglasses. She has this wildly young toy boy, you know, accompanying her. She has all, you know, the smartest kind of lines in it, but it's offering you zero difference from anything else you've ever seen.
And the daughter is played by Annie Murphy as well. But as you list out the people who are involved there, it's an incredible cast.
Stellar cast, but it's one of those shows that you will watch and you'll go, oh, I know Annie Murphy. Oh, she was in Schitt's Creek. Mm. Oh, I know Christine Baranski. She was in The Good Fight. I know Mark Strong. What was it? When you get to the end of that list, you'll realise that they've all done better things and that they're all better than the material here. And it's such a shame to see such good ideas, because there are good ideas in here wasted on a format that was tired the first time around. And one of the best ideas, I think, is Jen mentioned Murray Bartlett there. I mean, he's good in everything. The White Lotus, Last of Us.
I want to know more about him. I've only seen episode one, but I want to know what his stick is.
Yeah, his story is terrific. Yeah. He's basically a disgraced children's TV presenter and a puppeteer who had this huge Sesame Street-like show all to himself. He was sort of a Mr. Rogers character that America loved. And he had a meltdown on set one day, and unfortunately that was it. That was the end of him. That was the end of his show. And because the dosing has started in this wellness retreat, and he didn't know it, I think he eats some chocolate and he doesn't realise that there are drugs. And he starts to imagine his puppet coming to life. These are great ideas. Yeah, put them into a completely different show and I'd watch it. But here, it's all a bit too wasted.
His relationship with Agnes, the ex-nun, who's played by Dolly de Leon, who also was in an Eat the Rich drama itself, the film The Triangle of Sadness, which is excellent, I have to say. Their relationship,
and
their chemistry is great.
And she's wonderfully quiet for lots of it, which makes it more interesting.
The high point of the whole series is the interaction between the two of them, because it has an emotional resonance. And last season, all of the characters kind of felt like cardboard cutouts for me, except for Michael Shannon's character. He had this emotional register within the show, and I think they're the standouts between them, Marie Bartlett and Dolly de Leon. They're the only ones that are there to watch.
Stars from you on this one, Jen.
I mean, Nicole Kidman is... I love Nicole Kidman, but she's pure hologram here. She's in hologram mode. This is not the Nicole of Dogville or Baby Girl. She's gone through the motions, and we've seen her do that before in The Perfect Couple. And I just don't think the rich are that interested anymore. Like, I don't think they're that interested in them.
You need to make us be interested in them as characters, and these are kind
exactly.
Of just
and I think one, the book adaptation was enough, and this story is pretty threadbare.
Stars.
Two.
And what, two stars? What are you saying, Chris?
I think it's an unnecessary follow up. It's quite chilly, clueless, charmless, and I'm really tired at this stage. We talked about it when we were reviewing The Perfect Couple earlier this year. I'm tired of the Nicole Kidman Rich People series. I think that, that format needs to die. So, two stars.
Yeah, I think I know how you feel about it, Chris. Got a sense of your frustration there. Let's move on to. Another series from Nine Strangers, with this time we're going to a group of close friends, in particular two very close friends. Paramount's Little Disasters explores the dilemma a doctor is faced with when she suspects her friend might have caused injuries to her own child. That's the basic setup, which, and there are other, there's a group of friends around these two women, Jen, who were in a birthing group together, some years previously when all of their children were born. But that basic setup and that dilemma of, there's a scene where the doctors said, you are the child's doctor, you are the woman's friend. It really, that's a good dilemma.
It is a good dilemma, and it does make it compelling, as in you do, this is a perfect binge watch for anybody, because you do want to see how this is unfolding, and it is based on the novel of the same name by Sarah Vaughan. And it really is kind of this look at motherhood, like the actual scope of motherhood, because you're going heavy into these four women's ideas around motherhood, what they do for their children. Say with Jess, the main character, Diane Kruger's character, whose child is in the hospital, it's about her being this type A mother who doesn't vaccinate her children, very affluent, but also is a helicopter parent and everything has to be done to perfection. Then Liz, Jo Joyner's character, she is working in the A&E. She's a doctor. She is a pure working mother who is, you know, struggling at times to actually be present as a mother and the guilt that goes along with that. So they are all different archetypes of what motherhood is and the spectrum of motherhood as it is, and the way society puts this undue pressure on women as mothers.
Yeah. All right. Let's have a listen to a clip from early on. This is where Jo Joyner, as the ER doctor Liz, is examining a distressed child that her friend Jess, played by Diane Kruger, has brought in.
I've got a boggy swelling there.
What?
Betsy bump her head. Jess, could Betsy have had some kind of accident?
No.
She's got some swelling on the back of her head. Maybe some bruising.
Actually, yeah, she did. She did bang her head earlier. I just didn't think it was serious.
How?
She slipped and banged it.
What time is this?
Like 5:30 maybe.
And where was she when this happened?
She was crawling in the living room. I think she must have, pulled herself up. I don't know. I was in the kitchen at the time getting a snack for Frankie. I was gone for a second.
Okay, I can take it from here. Thanks, Ronan.
Yep. Thank you.
Do we get you warm? Do we keep you warm? It's okay. Accidents happen, right?
There you go. Jo Joyner as Dr. Liz there. And she had called another doctor and has to be present for that initial examination. That's the character that she dismisses. But obviously that character has heard what has just been said. And Diane Kruger playing the character of Jess, who is the mother of the injured child. We do seem to be in another rich person. Now, we're not in the top 1% here. These are professional people with good incomes, and some of them with beautiful houses. and disgustingly gorgeous kitchens.
Lovely kitchens, yeah. I was sitting there taking notes from Liz's kitchen, Jess's kitchen. Yeah, I mean, there's a point in this series where I think this show would like to think that it's prestige telly. And it does talk a big talk, and it does tackle some very important topics, whether it's alcoholism and domestic abuse or postnatal anxiety, maternal OCD. There's some very serious themes and ideas here. But at the same time, it's a soap. It really is. And I think maybe two episodes in, I kind of just settled with that. I just thought, okay, this thing is not Big Little Lies. Yeah. It really, really wants to be Big Little Lies. I mean, aside from the fact that it's, you know, exploring these female friendships that, you know, on the outside seem perfect, but there's so many problems going on, it actually mimics a narrative gimmick that Big Little Lies had, where you have the main characters talking down the camera.
Yeah,
filling in the blanks and sort of explaining what's going on. Not quite in the same way that Big Little Lies did, but yeah, I found the melodrama actually quite entertaining. Yeah. Once I settled with that, I actually liked it. Yeah.
And so the Joe Joyner character is this, you know, hassled A&E doctor. The Diane Kruger character, who's also involved in this as an executive producer, she is she's a very wealthy woman, doesn't she? She's at home, and as you say, she's helicoptering every. And there are two other main women in this circle.
There's Charlotte. She's played by Bridgerton Shelley Conn, and she is a career-driven lawyer, and she's having fertility issues. And then there's also Mel, played by Emily Taff, and she is kind of
Irish actress.
Yes, and she's great. She's like kind of one of these scrappy, fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants kind of parents that a lot of people will relate to.
Yeah, but she'll get the plane to the ground, but she'll get it up into the air.
She's more about hugs and forgiveness than, you know, Diane Kruger's character would be more get your homework done and clean up after. You know, so that's the dichotomy there.
And they all have very handsome husbands.
Well, I mean, according to you, Sean. Well, not my taste, but I think that, yeah, the husbands are there. And the thing about it is you see them on holiday, you see them interacting together. There is one holiday in the south of France that kind of goes awry, and you can see the kind of communication breakdown or, you know, the problems between the women kind of develop. It made me want, because you're focusing on this central drama about what is happening to this child.
And those aspects that we hear, they're done in flashback. And I must say, there were times now, are we just before the accident, whatever happened to the child, or are we years ago? I found sometimes it was a little bit confusing.
It is confusing. And I think that knockabout nature, though, of those scenes where they're all together made me kind of think about Cold Feet and think about what's the problem of, you know, getting rid of the central drama and just having a Cold Feet kind of series. Is that gone again? Is it ever going to kind of come back to something like that? But to say that, because it's so reliant on this, you know, mystery that must be solved and a thriller kind of aspect, it is a bit clunky. Because they're always going to throw in these twists about, say, Diane Kruger's character has seen, in a flashback, she has seen telling Joe Joyner's character, I don't want to have another child. Cut to her announcing, you know, a year later that she's pregnant again. So you're wondering all the time, what does this mean about her husband, their relationship? It's always planting seeds, but it doesn't do it in a subtle way.
Yeah, and there are some big, you know, clunky setups in that respect. But there, some of the setups, they're setting up quite serious topics to be discussed. I mean, at the end of episode one, wondering what is the story with the Diane Kruger character with her husband? What kind of husband is he?
Yeah,
you know, and it does make it ask, and there are other very serious topics being approached here.
There are, but they'll keep the central mystery that will remain unsolved until the final episode. But there are other mysteries. This thing is full of red herrings and it's full of cliffhangers. Every episode clocks in around like the 45-minute mark, and every single episode ends with a huge cliffhanger. So it's purposely designed to be gobbled up. You know, it wants you to watch another one, which I did. And I think that's maybe all part of the fun. There are some serious issues in there, but I think it also it's also there to kind of like, look, it'll never be boring watching good actors play annoying characters fighting around a dinner table. That kind of stuff will always be entertaining, and that's the reason why I kept going from
stars
one to the other.
From you on this one,
yeah, I had fun with it. Again, I had to just settle with it after a while, but look, 4 stars.
Solid 4,
I hated
Than solid 4, actually,
I hated the device of the breaking the fourth wall where they're doing these interviews, because I think it's a novelistic device, and surely in a drama series those inconsistencies in the story and mistruths have to be sown throughout the drama rather than them telling you of these inconsistencies.
Show it rather than tell us.
So I found that annoying. I think Joe Joyner is great. She's always good. I'd give it a solid 3, because you will want to keep watching till the end no matter how irritating you do find it.
Okay. Okay. And Little Disasters is on Paramount, as I said. And finally then, Netflix, more affluent interiors. Now, this is a whole other level of island affluence and more wellness, in fact, as well, in Sirens. Julianne Moore is a guru. Kiki Kell. We have two sisters, Devon and Simone. They are not very alike, the two sisters, it has to be said, Chris.
No, they're not. No, when we first meet Devon, she is just walking out of a police station. It's her second DUI. Her life is a bit all over the place. She cares for her father, played by Bill Camp, who's showing signs of early onset dementia. She's having an affair with her boss. She works at a fast food joint, and her boss is married. Everything has just gone wrong for her. And at some point, it was all supposed to go right. You know, she was the one from her family who went to college, but she dropped all of that to look after her younger sister Simone, who now has disappeared. So at the beginning of this series, played by Millie Alcock.
Yeah.
So at the beginning of the series, you have Devon, played by Megan Fahey. She's texting her sister Sirens, and that's a thing that they have to let one another know, I need you.
I'm in trouble.
I'm in trouble.
Yeah, and let's have a listen. So we see her coming out of a police station, essentially. Yeah. She's been in there overnight, and she makes her way home to her dad, and this is what greets her when she goes in to talk to her father.
Would go head to head with Hitler's and French. She's getting in
and
into the car.
Yeah. Rough night, it's impounded.
Again?
Jeez. Could your movie be any louder?
Leave it. I like it, it's good company. What's that?
It's an edible arrangement, I found it on the stoop.
A what?
It's, a flower arrangement made out of fruit. You're supposed to eat it.
Who the hell sent us that?
Oh, Simone.
Why would she send us fruit?
Because she is a self-centered gutter rat whore.
Don't talk about your sister like that. She was nice to send this. Oh, a strawberry.
Dad. There's beer and Stouffer's pizza in the kitchen. I'll be back.
Where are you going? Devon!
And there we have Bill Camp as Bruce the dad and Megan Fahey as Devon, one of the pair of sisters that feature in Sirens. And off she goes with the big bouquet of fruit off out to the island, which is an enormous trip for her on bus and ferry and all the rest of it, to confront her sister, which is a little bit of a dodgy. I kind of thought, really?
Well, I mean, she is at breaking point. You do feel for Megan Fahey's character, Devon, because she's there, you know, struggling with her dad. And she, as far as she knows, Simone is off living the high life.
Won't answer the phone
and Simone won't talk to her. And she's like, you know, you're neglecting your responsibilities as a sister, and I'm left holding the book. And Simone is the polar opposite of Devon. So when we meet her, she is Kiki's assistant on this island.
Kiki played by Julianne Moore. Who can do no wrong in my book.
So she, you know, Simone is perky, she's preppy, she's a super organised do-gooder who's Kiki's assistant. She's, you know, organising her underwear drawer. She's, you know, spritzing it with lavender, and she's organising this Labour Day gala. That's where we first meet her, and she has to make sure that, you know, everything is going smoothly. But she also has this very strange relationship with Kiki, where you're wondering, is it employee or is it mentor-mentee, or are they real-life best friends? Can they be best friends? Or what is the power dynamic between the two of them? So when Devon arrives, it's like a bomb going off, because she is there as the reality, Simone's reality, the reality she tried to escape from, the working class life in Buffalo that she hasn't told Kiki about, and she hasn't even told her, you know, about her sister really at all. So
skeletons. The boyfriend that she has, and there seems to be a genuine relationship between the two of them.
But all these skeletons are arriving at her doorstep, and it's, you know, reaching boiling point about how she's going to handle it. Whereas Devon is kind of like the audience surrogate. She is arriving on this island, looking around at Kiki and her husband, thinking, who are these weirdos? What is going on?
Who are they, Chris? Because what we have essentially is we have a whole bundle of people working on the island who do nothing that Kiki doesn't approve of. No smoking, no eating, all food is controlled, all types of control. And a group of very wealthy people who arrive to her kind of almost guru-like status.
Oh, it's weird. It's a fantasy. And maybe that's why Simone is drawn to it, because her life growing up was such chaos that to come into something where everything has to be in order, that's a dream come true for her. And also, Simone didn't have a mother growing up, so her mother figure here is Julianne Moore's Kiki. Kiki is, she's a billionaire, but actually she's the wife of a billionaire, and she's actually his second wife. And the big mystery is no one really knows what happened to the first wife. And her husband is played by Kevin Bacon, which, you know, gets an extra star straight away. He's from old money, but he also has a business. All of that stuff really isn't important. What's important is that their relationship is seemingly in trouble, and Michaela is kind of distracting herself with this big gala over the Labor Day weekend, and it has to be perfect, and she's obsessed with birds. Simone, well, maybe not Simone, but Devon, who arrives at, you know, for Labor Day weekend and throws a grenade into the mix, she thinks that Michaela might be the leader of a cult, and the show is maybe trying to make you think that that's the case. She has all of these strange meetings with her friends. One of them is Peter, a guy who, Peter's the husband, sorry. There's a friend played by Glenn Howerton, who Simone is in a relationship. He lives up the road. Every time they finish their meetings, they all say hey, hey to one another. Hey, hey. So it is very much like a cult. My problem was that the show keeps on teasing things that it doesn't really deliver on. Like, there's actually a very simple story here. This was actually originally a play.
And yet it has been stretched out into how many?
Yeah, it's been stretched out. And the thing is, it's quite short.
It's
for Netflix.
Episodes.
Yeah.
Episodes,
so for a Netflix series, 5 hours is actually quite short. But this
a lot longer than the average play, though.
A lot longer, yes.
But also, with that kind of like aspect of Stepford Wives kind of aspect, because you do feel like maybe Kiki is controlling these women that appear at the compound, but she has this kind of almost supernatural ability, it feels like, during this series. Yeah. But then that gets dropped.
And it goesn't go anywhere.
And it's really bizarre.
Even Julianne Moore can't cover
up. The thing I will say about Julianne Moore is she is having so much fun here. And it's very different to Nicole Kidman's performance in Nine Perfect Strangers, because I feel like Julianne Moore is dialed into this, and her kind of kooky demeanour, it makes you curious about what the origin story behind Kiki is, because there's a bit of a grit there to her and a tenacity. And it's high camp. It's, you know, she has this knowingness to her performance. I love Megan Fahey. I think Megan Fahey is outstanding in everything she does. And I think you're, as Devon, it makes you want to follow this character because she injects a realism to it that's quite powerful. And there is darker, serious issues here, but it gets caught up too much in the fantasy of this world. Yeah. You will be playing not only 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon with Kevin Bacon in it, but you will be looking at everybody going, Megan Fahey was in The White Lotus and The Perfect Couple, who is, you know, they're all in something. But I do feel it's too ambitious for its own good, unfortunately. So I give it a 2.5.
2.5. Chris?
It's going to have to be similar. I think that there's not a false note in place when it comes to performances. Moore is great. Howerton's brilliant. Bacon is always very good. I just think it sets up all of these weird things that it never really fully explores. It takes a very ordinary route in the end, and I think it's all set up and no payoff. Viewers, I'm not going to give anything away, but they will be disappointed with the finale, as I was. So 2.5.
All right. Little Disasters streaming on Paramount. Sirens is available on Netflix. Nine Perfect Strangers on Prime Video. Just a couple of terrestrials for those of you who are interested. A real Judy Garland, Liza Minnelli tone to proceedings this weekend. Judy, the film, the Renée Zellweger biopic of the legendary singer, is tonight, BBC Two at 11 p.m. Saturday, a documentary about Judy's daughter, Liza, is on BBC Two, 9 p.m. It's called Liza, Truly Terrific, Absolutely True Story. And on Saturday, New York, New York, the new Scorsese and De Niro film starring Liza Minnelli, Saturday, BBC Two at 10:40 p.m. So well worth chasing up Judy Garland over the weekend. Thank you to Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon. And as Julianne Moore might say, hey, hey.
Hey, hey.
So to our album reviews, this week we're taking a look at three new album releases from artists at very different stages of the career. Those three artists being Sparks, Amble and Stereolab. Sparks, Los Angeles duo of Ron and Russell Mail brothers, have built one of the most enduring legacies in pop since the early 1970s. I think they're 50 years in the business, I read somewhere. Sparks consistently pushing boundaries of genre. You can't pin them down. And there are those that will enjoy their trademark wit and theatrical flair. Latest album is called Mad with an exclamation mark. It follows the recent resurgence in public interest, possibly fueled by a documentary and a string of inventive late career releases. Next then we have Irish trio Amble. Debut album is called Reverie, released on Warner Brothers. It's already attracting large audiences, impressive streaming numbers, sold out shows around the country. Usher McCaffrey, Ross McNerney and singer Robbie Cunningham recorded most of the album Live. And finally, Stereolab, defining voice in alternative music throughout the 90s and early noughties. Their release, Instant Holograms on Metal Films, falls off the tongue every time I say it, and it marks another chapter in their recent return to the studio. With me in studio this evening is Zara Hedeman and Eamon Sweeney. Let's start with Sparks and a track called Hit Me Baby. There we Hit Me Baby, the title of the track, and that from Sparks and their new album called Mad! Exclamation mark. I think it's in one of their press releases, is it, that they said that they had several committee meetings around the exclamation mark. And it kind of explains the level of humour that Sparks are involved in. Huge career, and you couldn't pin down if you listen to one album and listen to the next one after it. You say, is that the same band sometimes?
Absolutely, and that's something that I think has been my favourite thing about them. They've always been forward pushing and always doing new things and being so successful in it. And with that, they've such a huge slew of like fans, like Sonic Youth, Joy Division. I think Nirvana listened to them a lot when they were in the recording studio. And with that, like in the different genres between disco, glam rock, they're always really maximalist, as we heard there with their arrangements and production. Russell Mayall's falsetto was always just such an endearing and captivating element. And then, as we say, like the humour to them, like the lyrics on this, they're so funny. They have these surreal kind of stories. They have a song here called Jansport Backpack, which you might think was like a jingle for like the bag.
Yeah.
But it's actually kind of, when you listen to it, it's about like his lover like leaving him, and all you see is the back of the bag.
Yeah, it's a very interesting way of looking at it. And there's another one called Running Up a Tab at the Hotel for the Fab. You know, they enjoy that kind of silly rhyme. But how do they, as Zara was describing it there, Eamon, particularly on that that track about the backpack.
Yeah.
You could think this is nothing more than a little novelty act, and these are novelty songs with novelty rhymes and
kind of
novelty performance. How
true.
Have they wouldn't be there 50 years later if that's all they were doing.
Oh, absolutely. And I think
how do they avoid that?
They avoid that, actually. It's one of these albums, I think initially it took me a while to get into because there's different layers to it. I think lyrically, for example, Hit Me Baby, that track that we just heard, there's a lyric in it about nightmares being surreal and vivid. And it actually is their right comment on Trump's America. So underneath all this kind of goofing around and the kind of the moustache and those, all that, there is a serious heart of the band. You have to dig a little bit to get it. It's not kind of in your face so much. The in your face stuff is almost a bit of a distraction at times. They're a fascinating band. Endlessly entertaining. And as you say, over 50 years, 54 years to be precise, 1971.
How many albums?
They formed 28. This is their 28th album.
28th.
And this town ain't big enough for the two of us, Sean.
Yeah.
That's 74.
Yeah. So. Some older people told me about that. They do get a little bit serious once or twice in the album. Let's have a listen to a track called Drowned in a Sea of Tears. Drowned in a Sea of Tears from Sparks on their new album Mad. There was something, Zara Hedeman, that struck me listening across. It's a 12 track album, 45 minutes. I was kind of surprised on several of the songs. I would think it's over now, and I'd look, I'm only 2.5 minutes in. But I kind of wondered, did they stretched some of these songs a bit too far?
I think so. That was one of my main issues with this album. And I was saying to Eamon before we came in here that this was the first Sparks album that I've had to listen to quite a few times to really get into. Because even with that song, Drowned in a Sea of Tears, I really loved like that piano or electric piano ripple throughout it. I thought that was really nice. But then they switch it up and do something completely different with it, which I really didn't love. There's another instance of that on one of the songs. I think it's Along Red Light, where I really liked where it began, and then it just goes off the rails.
Well, lovely orchestral at the beginning, but then it just keeps repeating a long red light, and you're thinking, this is a long repetition of a long red light.
Yeah, and I think that's a little bit of the maximalism of their act kind of taking over a bit and trying to cram too much into it. And I think as well, like something with Sparks, across their career, one thing they really wanted to do is do a soundtrack for a film, which they only really did in 2021 with an Jeanette. Yeah. And that was hugely operatic. So that is in this, but to excess.
Yeah, I mean, but fans of Sparks, and they are numerous within the music world and within this country as well, I think there's a huge fan base for them. Two nights, did you say?
They do two nights at the National Stadium.
In July.
In July, which is extraordinary. And they have said in interviews for this album that, you know, we're having a late career renaissance. Even if you don't like the records, more people are buying them and more people are buying tickets.
Was the documentary, the recent documentary, was that, do you think, part of the reason
helped
for that?
Yeah. And what they said about that, what they said, one of the most gratifying things for them was realising that so many people, like whether it be from Thurston Moore to Alex Capricanos from Franz Ferdinand, all these different diverse people. Zara earlier mentioned at the back, like Joy Division, found them inspirational. That's how long they've been around. Yeah. Mm. And I think they've been getting their dues in recent years. They've just got so much personality. They do great interviews.
I have to say, I remember speaking to them at the time of the interview of the documentary. Yeah. And they were the nicest guys you could meet.
Yes.
And there was no holes were barred. You know, whatever you wanted to hear, they were going to tell you this story well. And they knew how to answer the way they wanted to answer.
You don't get that much anymore with artists. So that's
so different. Did you enjoy overall Eminent Stars?
Yeah, I did. I would give it a solid 3.5, say.
3.5, Zara. Are you a little bit happier with Sparks? I think you possibly are more of a fan than Eamon, potentially.
Like my love for this album grew increasingly during the week, and I just love something with them that I love is that they are clearly music fans, which is very evident. So for me, it's a 3. It's not my favourite of theirs, but I will return to certain songs.
You will return to certain songs. What did you say, stars-wise?
3.
Sorry? 3. Yeah. All right. That is for Sparks and Mad. Let us move on then to Reverie, new album, well, debut album, in fact, from Amble. An Irish trio, Zara, that to say they have had a rapid ascent is understating it. They had a couple of EPs and now they're signed to Warner Music and packing huge stadiums out. And also huge streaming numbers.
Yeah, they have sold out 3 shows in the 3 Olympia. They've sold out the 3 Arena. Dermot Kennedy invited them to play in his Mishnock Festival. They have a slew of celebrity fans from Robbie Henshaw, James Lowe, John O'Shea, Damien Duff was at the 3 Olympia show. So they're huge. And across the water as well, like it seems like in Australia, in America, they have a big audience. And as you said, big streaming numbers, 100 million streams.
Yeah.
So it's
that's a lot of streaming.
And also to consider, they only formed in late 2022.
Yeah, and here we are in 2025. I'm going to play a track called Marley Park, and you talk about people in Australia and people in America. So picture yourself, you lived in and around Marley Park all through your teens and maybe into a little bit of your 20s, then you had to move abroad for work, etc., etc. And this is the song that plays when you go to a concert.
We were singing Nelly, California, walking down to Marley Park. I was hoping you and me, we'd talk, we'd laugh, we'd be dancing in the dark. Your old man told me you're his joy, his
Marley
queen,
Park. You're such cynics, the pair of you. I'm here with me hanky in me pockets saying, if you were living abroad and you heard that song, you would be crying.
I'd throw up.
That's because you're living here in Ireland at home and you don't have, you're lucky enough not to be abroad. But you can see the market that they're going for will lap this up because it will tug at their heartstrings.
In some ways, this is an act of marketing genius because obviously this Irish folk and tradition revival in recent years that's been brilliant. But the Lancomes and the Lisa O'Neills are not mass market material. Yeah. You play somebody who wouldn't be into traditional Irish music, either act to go, ooh, Rady Peach or Lisa O'Neill's voice is a bit, but replace it, make this kind of sterilised, folky kind of Paolo Nutini, Mumford and Sons kind of thing with this very bland vocal, people lap it up. Lap it up.
I think Eamon is gentler on this album than you are, Zara.
Oh. I didn't expect that one. Perhaps, I just found this a very cynical record. Just even that song. I love Here Comes the Sun. That's a lovely ditty that they've tried to appropriate here. Elsewhere, they've done like a little slowed down version of Wonderwall. They have Mumford & Sons, as Eamon has mentioned. It was just very temple barification of traditional folk music.
Yeah, it'd be very hard. The guy, all of them sing, but you know, but particularly the fellow's voice, I don't know which of the voices we just heard.
Robbie,
he has a lovely voice. It's very easy to listen to, and he pulls you in.
I didn't find it very easy to listen to across 14 of the songs, and this
it overstays its welcome. But so did Sparks.
But at least Sparks, though, were innovative and they were doing something new. They're grabbing me. This is just so run-of-the-mill. It's so vacuous. It's so dull as well. Oh, yeah. And even just on a technical level, I thought the mix was terrible. Like, I actually thought the mix of the vocals was very bad in how there's the reverb on Robbie Cunningham's vocals. I found that very grating. And that is to do with the technique of recording it. They did it live. And for the instrumentation, the instrumentation is lovely.
There are some good arrangements.
Live recording of that does bring a kind of intimacy to it, I guess. But Robbie Cunningham's vocals, to be pedantic, is too close in the mix for me.
I liked it. His voice, that is. Let us listen to Treehouse Wings. There you go. I just wanted to let a little bit of that instrumental play, a bouzouki, I think, is what we're hearing there. I'm almost afraid to go back to the pair of you on this one. It does feel like 14 singles, but taken in small chunks like that, does it work, Eamon?
Listen, regardless of what me and Zara say or think about this record, or it really doesn't matter. I can actually see this band being a lot bigger than they already are. They could win Grammys or something, or it could be a flash in the pan and we never hear from them again. I think it's going to go either way. Do you know what? It's not bad. It's dull. I think its worst crime here is that, as Zara kind of said, it's dull, it's bland, it's boring, it's so middle of the road, you feel like you're going to get run over. That's basically my bottom line on it. For effort and in terms of the success that the lads are getting, more power to them, and I give them credit for that. But it's not my thing. 2.5, say.
2.5. Zara?
Just lines like, there's no Bonnie Lass waiting for me, I would lay down my folly and knock on fishing with thee. young men in their 20s singing Danny California, Red Hot Chili Peppers fans of. So that's an interesting duality. So for me, I just thought there was no substance to this. Again, as Eamon said, it doesn't really matter what we kind of think because they're so successful. So the 1.5 probably won't mean anything really to them either.
You don't begrudge them their success, I'm presuming, in the midst of all of that.
I'm Irish, so yes.
All right, we'll be back with our third album after these. Okay, Zara Hadam and Eamon Sweeney still with me. We've spoken about Sparks and Amble. Now we're moving on to Stereolab. Back after 15 years of silence, not into the short titles. Instant Holograms on Metal Films is the title of the album. Melody is a Wound is the title of this track. Only giving you a little flavour of Melody is a Wound from Instant Holograms on Metal Films from Stereolab. Even the title of the album and some of the titles of some of the tracks, Vermin F's Transistor, I'm looking at that in particular, as Plastic Creeping Eruption, another of the titles. Stereolab, despite 15 years of silence, are giving us what Stereolab have always given us. Is that fair to say, Eamon?
Absolutely, yeah. I find this a very, very comforting, surprisingly pleasant, surprisingly, shockingly good record. To be in a way, 16 years. Funny enough, me and Zara were just saying, since they announced, they didn't say they're splitting up, they were going on an indefinite hiatus. it's almost more or less exactly the same amount of time as Oasis were away. And there would have been contemporaries around that time. But obviously, this is going to get a fraction of the coverage, which is kind of unfair because this is a brilliant pop record. Whatever about these kind of electrified teeny bop and all these mad titles, it's a great, great record.
There's some great music on this. How new are they to use, Sarah, Stereolab?
I've been a fan for a while, Sean. I know it. I've been a fan for quite a while.
For my presumption.
I came to them in the last kind of 8-10 years because I'm a big fan of Broadcast, who are another band that are very similar, but what I love about them is just how like 1960s kind of they sound sometimes.
It's real retro.
Like the analogue and the vintage synths they use, and like we were dancing away in the studio, but there's a darkness underlying to the lyrics, which I find very interesting. Like on this they talk about like capitalism, greed. Like I think there's a line on that song that we heard saying like the goal is to manipulate, heavy hands to intimidate. So they're talking about the chokehold of political corruption on people.
Mm. Stars from this for you, Zara?
I loved this. This was a 4.5 for me.
And from you, Eamon?
I would go 4.5.
4.5. 10 seconds. What old album have you been listening to? The Sun brought you to?
Searching for the Young Soul Rebels by Dexys Midnight Runners, and it's just an absolute masterpiece in the sunshine. A masterpiece, regardless of the weather.
Even if the weather wasn't good. And Zara?
Steely Dan's Katie Light.
Ah.
Big sunshine song, album. Yeah.
So we're all into the sunshine this week, and the three albums that we reviewed, Sparks Mad, Amble Reverie, Stereolab, Instant Holograms and Metal Films. Sara Hederman and Eamon Sweeney are two reviewers, and that is our lot for this Friday evening. Liam Mullen was the sound supervisor this evening. Aina Thacker was the broadcast coordinator. Liam Murphy was the researcher, and the programme was produced by Sean O'Gorman. Back with you Monday, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.